The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're already here at the end of the week, last broadcast for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show until Monday, and lots to get to on today's program. First, I should mention that my father has another public appearance campaign scheduled for Columbus, Ohio, and that will be this Sunday night, I believe, Sunday night and Monday night. So you'll be looking for more information on that, I'm sure, and hopefully we can provide some of that early on next week just to keep you informed of the turnout and some of the follow-up plans. So we'll certainly do our best to let you know the excitement that will surely be in the air in those two sessions. And speaking of the public Bible lectures, we have the Belfast campaign planned for January 19th and 20th, early next year. And already we've had 26 people register for the first night of the event. We really were wondering how many. I think we had about 10% of the Trumpet subscribers that we had for the London campaign. So we were thinking this was going to be considerably smaller, but already we've gotten about the same percentage of respondents that we got from London, and this is just after the first invite went out. We've got a great ad campaign that's scheduled for Sunday Life in Northern Ireland, I think it's called. That begins this Sunday, and then we're going to run that ad or a string of ads for three straight weeks in the hope that we can boost our Trumpet circulation numbers up there. And I've really been trying to encourage viewers to the TV program over here to sign up for the Trumpet magazine as well, so that they can be then invited to the PAC appearances in this part of the world. So we'll certainly keep you posted as the developments unfold in the next several weeks. Well, all kinds of important anniversaries to talk about. Today, as I've been mentioning this week, Sunday marks the centenary anniversary of the end of World War I. And in Ephraimite nations, November 11th is called Remembrance Day. I guess you could say it's Britain's version of Veterans Day. And it's in memory of all those who've sacrificed their lives in war, and they do put a special emphasis on World War One, many people in this part of the world, here in the UK, they will wear a red poppy on their dress or jacket lapel to commemorate the soldiers who died in war. Poppies are the flowers that grew on those battlefields following the Great War, where so many British and other soldiers died, shed their blood, and in those fields, as I say, poppies grew in them. And so to commemorate that, many of them will wear that a little red poppy on their lapel. Coming up in today's show, a little bit later, we're going to look back on World War One, that era, and see, as we discussed yesterday, some of the lessons that we can take away from it, some of the important developments for Britain, for example. Even though they were one of the victors, it did nevertheless mark the beginning of the end for the British Empire. So we'll talk more about that coming up in the final segment. Today is November 9th, and that marks the 80-year anniversary of Kristallnacht, or the Night of the Broken Glass. This is when Adolf Hitler incited riots and basically triggered Germany's campaign to destroy European Jewry. November 9th, 1938, the Nazis murdered 91 German Jews, I think it was, and they sent thousands and thousands of Jews to concentration camps, and they destroyed all kinds of synagogues and Jewish businesses. Kristallnacht, that was the first Nazi pogrom against the Jews, and it got its name because of all the glass, the broken glass, the shredded glass on the streets that night in Germany. Now, that happened just 80 years ago. 80 years ago. And it's easy for us to think that, well, nothing like that could happen again, but look at all of the acts of violence aimed at Jews today. I mean, just in the United States recently, that Pittsburgh synagogue, I mentioned Melanie Phillips' piece following that tragedy, where she said that when a culture falls apart, people invariably turn on the Jews. Anti-Semitism is always the sign of a terminal cultural sickness. So it's a sign. We can look at this and see that, okay, there's a sickness, and we ought to be concerned about it. 80 years ago, this piece from Euronews, just this week, it says, France has the largest Jewish community in Europe, around 550,000 people. Increasingly, however, many say they no longer feel safe in their country. Jews in France, Jews in our modern Europe, who no longer feel safe. It says both synagogues and Jewish schools are heavily protected because of fears of terrorism. And then this article says that it's estimated that 3,000 Jews leave France every year out of fear. Most of them move to Israel. 3,000 Jews every year. I mean, this is common. This hostility, this persecution that's aimed at Jews. And we ought to watch out, as Melanie Phillips said, when a culture falls apart, people invariably turn on the Jews. Anti-Semitism, it was quite popular in the 1930s. Mein Kampf, that was a bestseller for Hitler. William Manchester, in his book, talks about Mein Kampf being a popular graduation and wedding gift during the 1930s. It sold 6 million copies. It made Hitler a fortune. This diatribe, this hatred, this hateful message, this screed. The Times of London, just this week, more than half of Germans say they feel like strangers in their own land because of Muslim immigration, according to a study of the country's rising far-right tendencies. It says researchers also found that 1 in 9 believe the German population is naturally superior to other people. 1 in 9 Germans believe this. And they're happy to admit it on a survey. Yeah, we're superior. It says 1 in 3 thinks the state's been overwhelmed by foreigners to a dangerous degree. That's 1 out of every 3. And you can see why groups like the AfD are on the rise. And you can see why there's so much dissatisfaction with the more popular parties, with Angela Merkel's party. You can see why she's leaving. And now many others scrambling to take her place. The Times says right-wing extremists remain a fringe group in Germany, accounting for 8.5% of the population in the East and 5.4% in the West. But illiberal and anti-migrant views appear to be much more widespread. The report estimated that 42% of the public had authoritarian leanings, outnumbering the 29% firmly committed to the principles of democracy. So we're looking for trends. These are signs to watch for. What is it when you get an increasing number of people in Germany who prefer a more authoritarian government? It says, in all, 65% of Germans were judged to show pronounced signs of authoritarian aggression, such as the desire to shut out minorities or silence those who did not share their political opinions, and 44% would like a ban on Muslims moving to Germany. 44%, almost half of Germans. A ban, not just an increase in border security, a ban, not even a wall built to secure the border, but just a flat-out ban on Muslims. Listen to this last paragraph. It says, ethnic prejudices and yearnings for a leader who rules Germany with a strong hand for the good of the people were most common in the former states of East Germany, which were subject to authoritarian rule and experienced relatively low levels of immigration between 1949 and 1989. This last statement, nearly 40% of East Germans agreed to some extent that under certain circumstances, dictatorship is the best form of government for the national interest. That compares to 23% in the West. 40% in the East and 23% in the West, West Germany. The region that was democratic all those years when the nation was divided. Western, under the guidance and direction of the United States and Britain. Those are astounding figures. 40% say that, well, under certain circumstances, I think dictatorship would be the best form of government. And 23% in the West agree. You're probably not going to hear this on CNN. Probably not on Fox News either. As I said yesterday, it's as if all of us are sleepwalking into this nightmare, this explosion. My father in the Key of David booklet, he says, Nazi Germany exhibited fanatical hatred for Jews. The Nazis also used emotion to stir up repugnant hatred. The coming beast power will exhibit the same hatred for Jews as well. Most people who hate the Jews don't even know why they do. Can we see Satan behind such lies and hatred? We see all of this hatred between Jews and Muslims. Jews who are terrified in France, leaving in droves. The rise of the far right in Germany. The dissatisfaction with the leadership. And large percentages, 40% in the East, 23% in the West, that could see, I think, a dictatorship might be best. Wow. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 2 says, For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Eternal so comes as a thief in the night. It's going to catch most people by surprise. Verse 3 says, For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. It all happens suddenly. Even as some are saying, Hey, that's over and done with. That's 80 years ago. That's 100 years ago. We're so far advanced today. We're so much more sophisticated and developed. All of these modern conveniences. Many were saying the same thing coming into World War I and then again in World War II. All the diplomats were out in full force, waving peace agreements in front of everyone, saying, now we can finally relax. Now we can finally enjoy peace and tranquility. Paul said, Brethren, you are not in darkness, for that day should overtake you as a thief. You are the children of light and the children of the day. We're not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Don't fall asleep spiritually, not at this time, not ever, but certainly not now. Watch. Be alert spiritually. Peter said, watch unto prayer. That's how we bring life into our lives, spiritually, through prayer and study. Watch and be sober. Don't be spiritually drunk on the cares of this world. Be sober-minded. We have all these lessons to draw on from our own history, relatively recent history. 80 years ago today, Kristallnacht. That's what triggered all the persecution that the Nazi machine carried out against Jews in Europe, millions of them dying. sent to the concentration camps, extermination camps, 6 million of them. A number of years ago, columnist James Carroll, he made an interesting observation about that Kristallnacht anniversary. He said, if November 9th, 1938 can be taken as the beginning of Hitler's war, the end of it can be taken as coming on that day in 1989, when the Berlin Wall was breached. The Cold War, beginning in a Soviet-American argument over Berlin, can be understood as the long denouement, or outcome, a French word there, the long outcome of World War II. So he points then, this author, this columnist, to November 9th, 1989. That's when the Berlin Wall was breached. That's when Germany started to unite once again. A significant date, looking at prophecy. It truly did usher in a new era. Ron Fraser, the late trumpet columnist, he wrote an article way back in 1999. This is almost 20 years ago now. But he said he's just commenting on the significance of this date in 1989. It says, during the Cold War, history seems stuck in a time warp as the U.S. and Soviet Russia glared at each other over a concrete barrier slicing through the German city of Berlin. History revived on that fateful night, November 9th, 1989. This is 29 years ago, when the Berlin Wall fell. He says, in a sense, a history which had been held back, delayed for 40 years in the icy freeze of Cold War, was suddenly freed to pursue its ongoing course. We entered into a time of no more delay in the course of world events. The history of mankind was about to reach its crashing, globe-shattering climax. The fall of the Berlin Wall was to herald the dramatic acceleration of the European phenomenon, which had been somewhat stultified during the Cold War, the revival of European imperialism. Listen to this statement he concludes with. Simply put, the resurrection of that old imperial power, which has dominated history since 31 BC, the Roman Empire. So the wall came down, and then we see this dramatic acceleration of Europe, of this European phenomenon. It was held back by the Cold War, but now we see the revival of European imperialism. I mean, this is so important, this history. It's, as he said, it's dominated the last 2,000 years. My father talked about this on a program, this no more delay. That comes out of a verse in Revelation 10, Revelation 10 and verse 6. Listen to what my father had to say. This is back in 2014 on the Key of David program, clip 2.
You can read later Revelation 10, verses 5 and 6, where it talks about the God who created heaven and all the things that they're in, and earth and all the things that they're in, and the sea and all the things that are therein. This great God says there's going to be no more delay. It says time no longer, but it means no more delay. God is not going to hold things back anymore. He's going to bring all this to pass.
That's from my father's program back in 2014. He's commenting on Revelation 10 and verse 6 and pointing to that same date that Ron Fraser pointed to in that article I just quoted, November 9th, 1989. What a dramatic acceleration of events, prophetic events we've seen since that date. Of course, just before that, Herbert Armstrong died. He didn't quite live long enough to see that wall come down, but he had been prophesying of that for decades. He had been prophesying that Germany would not only unite, but that 10 nations in Europe would unite as the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. He knew that Germany had to be unified for that prophecy in Revelation 17 to be fulfilled. As he wrote in 1975, Germany will lead and dominate the coming United States of Europe. He didn't say West Germany. He didn't say East Germany. And keep in mind, when he wrote that, 1975, I mean, the nation was divided by this wall all across Europe. This Iron Curtain, as Churchill called it, a literal wall right there in Berlin. You may have heard this story before. We've written about it. We've talked about it on the program. When that wall came down in 1989, this news station from Seattle actually called the Worldwide Church of God, actually called the church that Herbert Armstrong established, God established it through him, and asked for the response. You know, what are you going to say? We've had your program on our station, and Herbert Armstrong has been talking about this, the unification of European states for decades. This is how the Worldwide Church representatives, keep in mind, this is just a few years after Mr. Armstrong's death, and this is how they wrote about the exchange they had with this station manager. It says, following the spectacular news about the opening of the Berlin Wall, we unexpectedly received a call from a news station in Seattle. The news director was well aware of the World Tomorrow program and the fact that for more than 40 years, the church had been predicting the reunification of Europe in some form. He asked for on-air comments about whether the church believed the opening of the wall was the commencement of end-time prophetic events. He was more excited than the Worldwide Church of God representatives. Because that station manager went away from that conversation disappointed. The leaders of the Worldwide Church of God, well, speaking of tearing things down, before the wall even came down, they had been tearing apart all of the traditions, the teachings, the doctrines, the work. We write about this history, this painful history, really. We write about it in Raising the Ruins. Mr. Armstrong's lifelong work, and they started to dismantle it piece by piece, even before he died. This PGR, or this publication where they talk about that conversation they had with the station manager in Seattle. This was their response to that station manager's question. We responded, it says, that it was premature to make statements like that. The news director was disappointed that we would not proclaim this to be the absolute beginning of end time events. But it was interesting, they say, that he did say that what the church has predicted from the Bible was remarkably close to what appears to be happening. This was a station manager who said to the Worldwide Church of God ministry, hey, you were right. You got it right. It's happening in some form or another. It's happening. What Mr. Armstrong prophesied. Some man who wasn't even in the church. And he had more spiritual discernment. He had a deeper prophetic understanding than those ministers who were taught at the feet of Herbert Armstrong. The church, by that point, by the point of the wall coming down in Germany, had lost its spiritual vision. Blindness had set in. And as we well know, those of us that have gone through this history or have read Raising the Ruins, the World Tomorrow program that Mr. Armstrong started, soon that was off the air. The Plain Truth circulation plummeted. They didn't have that that sure word of prophecy any longer. They didn't have it. That's why that station manager went away so disappointed. They had lost their spiritual vision. Some of you could well imagine, I think, what Herbert Armstrong would have said had that station manager called him just a few years earlier. If he would have been alive long enough to see the wall come down, imagine Mr. Armstrong's response. Imagine him telling that station manager about these great prophecies of God. I mentioned Revelation 10, obviously Revelation 17 and 13 about the beast power or the Daniel 2 image. You think about what Daniel the prophet of God, said to Nebuchadnezzar, there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. I mean, there was nothing even like that. Well, I thank you for asking. Let me tell you about the God of heaven. Let me tell you about the God who reveals secrets. You can see why the readership plummeted. You can see why they went off TV. You can see why they closed Ambassador College. You can see why the church, that church, is a mere shell of what it once was. They've abandoned all of the teachings, the traditions, as 2 Thessalonians 2 says, because they didn't love the truth. They didn't love the truth. One-third of the Bible, prophecy from God, most of it for our time today. And people turned out in droves to listen to Mr. Armstrong, whether it was a pack in Belfast or on his weekly television program or daily radio or the Plain Truth magazine or the Good News magazine or the Youth magazine, the co-worker letters, the Pastor General's report, all of it. They turned out in droves to hear what he had to say because he would challenge them. Look, don't believe me. Believe your Bible. Blow the dust off your Bible. See what your Bible says. Only a few, and they're now in the Philadelphia Church of God, only a few were riveted by news events in late 1989. November 9th, 1989, the day that the Berlin Wall came tumbling down. The day history revived, as Mr. Fraser wrote. The day when prophetic events, as outlined in the inspired word of Almighty God, accelerated like never before. Germany reuniting. Of course, the Soviet Union broke apart. And that only allowed for Europe to come together faster. Russia has now reemerged. That too is prophetic, because their alliance, prophesied alliance, is with China and other Asian nations. And then you look at what's happened in the Middle East since that pivotal date, the rise of the King of the South through the 1990s and 2000s. And all through that time, you see America and you see Britain losing so much power and influence and wealth. And of course, the church, the history and the church that we've lived through during that same time period. My father wrote in the Last Hour book, as the biblical nations of Israel fall, namely America, Britain, and the Middle Eastern Jewish nation, spiritual Israel, or the church, is rising in power. That's speaking of the remnant church, this church, the one true church. He says, we must deliver a soul-scorching warning to Israel as they stumble and collapse. What a weighty responsibility we have as God's people. There's just so few of us. But here we are proclaiming God's truth. Proclaiming God's warning message in love, even as we see all of these spectacular prophecies being fulfilled. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send us some feedback, I've got a few emails I've collected. I'm not sure I'll have time to get into them today, but hopefully if I don't today, I can do it next week. But if you'd like to send in some comments, you can send it to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The Holy Roman Empire
has made pivotal and defining contributions to Western civilization. But its many reincarnations have also come with painful and catastrophic consequences. European leaders aim to unite the fractured continent of Europe by reviving the legacy of this extraordinary church-state combine. One of the great lessons of this empire is that it always comes back. There is always another resurrection. To understand much more on this vital subject, call now and request our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The Holy Roman Empire is not just a relic of history. It is about to play a central role in world events. Coming to understand about the nature and character of this powerful institution tells you as much about the future as it does about the past. As part of this free offer, also request Herbert Armstrong's classic work, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Both booklets are available at no cost or obligation to you. In addition to the free book, you may also request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet examines world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
There is going to be a resurrection of that old Roman Empire. Not very many people believe it, because people have gotten completely beyond really believing that the Bible means what it says. You're going to have to live and see it, and you're going to have to know that God was speaking when he said this thing is coming.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
I wonder, my friends, if you realize what a world you're living in. Conditions were never like this in any past time. Not until World War I broke out in 1914 has the world ever gone through times such as we are living in. Now, world news is more serious than you realize. Conditions are more grave than you dream. World-famous scientists know what is taking place, and they know that now it's becoming possible to annihilate human life off the face of the earth. They know what engines of destruction are being invented, and they tell us that nothing but world government can now preserve us and bring us world peace. That's all. Nothing but world government.
That's Herbert Armstrong, obviously, from one of his old radio programs, talking about where it all started, World War I. I saw an article the other day, something like 100 million human beings during the 20th century slaughtered, either in war or because of some tyrant, some dictator, some abusive dictator. 100 million people. World War I, 10, 12 million soldiers slaughtered in that war. It was so bad, it was so horrific, that it was labeled the Great War, the war to end all wars. Finally, this will stop war. I mean, who would want to go through this again? November 11th, that's this Sunday, it's Remembrance Day here in the UK. 100 years on, the centenary anniversary of the end of World War I. What have we learned? What have we learned from these lessons of history? Victor Davis Hanson, as he typically does on these kinds of anniversaries, he gives us a sweeping overview, saying how that in early 1918, it looked like the Central Powers were about to win. The Central Powers being Austria, Hungary, Germany, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire. Russia had given up in December of 1917, and America had only started sending troops over in mid-1917, I think it was, So they came into the war late, the United States. And the Central Powers were about to win. As soon as Russia gave up, they were able to redeploy their troops to the Western Front. About to win, and then finally in the summer of 1918, you had tens of thousands of American soldiers showing up. Thousands of them every day. Just a relentless attack, spearheaded by the United States. And then, as Victor Davis Hanson says, the war strangely ended with an armistice. With this armistice that then resulted in the Treaty of Versailles a few months later. He said that the Allied victors were in disarray following the end of this war. And then about the treaty, the peace treaty, he said this: "The Treaty of Versailles proved a disaster, at once too harsh and too soft. Its terms were far less punitive than those the victorious Allies would later dictate to Germany after World War II. Hitler, like I was saying yesterday, he came away from that saying that the Treaty of Versailles is unfair. It's too harsh. Really? Hanson says, earlier, Germany itself had demanded tougher concessions from the defeated France in 1871 and Russia in 1918. In the end, the Allies proved unforgiving to a defeated Germany in the abstract, but not tough enough in the concrete. There was some strong language. This is not going to happen again. Here's why. This is what we expect of Germany. But they didn't enforce that treaty. That's the real story about the Treaty of Versailles. It's not that it was overly harsh. It's that the West didn't enforce it. Hanson says one ironic result was that the victorious but exhausted Allies announced to the world that they never wished to go to war again. Meanwhile, the defeated and humiliated Germans seemed all too eager to fight again soon to overturn the verdict of 1918. They set out right away for round two, to prepare for round two. And the Allies, following that dreadful war, they announced right away that we're never going to war again. Hanson says the consequence was a far bloodier war that followed just two decades later. That's all that it took. It was just a short little recess between these two world wars. And then, well, now we have to number them with Roman numerals. It's not one great war to end all wars. Then there's a second world war. And now we're at the tail end of a recess between number two and number three. Hanson says here, what can we learn from the failed armistice of 1918? He writes, keeping the peace is sometimes even more difficult than winning a war. Should I repeat that? Keeping the peace is sometimes even more difficult than winning the war. Brings to mind what Herbert Armstrong said about our nations. How that we've been able in our history to win some wars, but we always lose the peace. That's exactly what he's saying right here. For an enemy to accept defeat, it must be forced to understand why it lost, suffer the consequences of its aggression, and only then be shown magnanimity and given help to rebuild. Losers of a war cannot pick and choose when to quit fighting in enemy territory. Had the Allies continued their offensive in the fall of 1918 and invaded Germany, the peace that followed might have more closely resembled the unconditional surrender and agreements that ended World War II, leading to far more than just 20 years of subsequent European calm. This is a historian. He sees the big picture. He sees that because the enemies weren't overcome with overwhelming force, Instead, it was an armistice. And it allowed Germany to come back in just 2 decades. Hansen says deterrence prevents war. Germany invaded Belgium in 1914 because it was convinced that Britain would not send enough troops to aid its overwhelmed ally, France. Germany also assumed that isolationist America would not intervene. See, he's assigning blame. Germany's the cause. This is why they invaded. And then it says that the Allies, 20 years later, less than that, they repeated the same mistakes. Germany currently dominates Europe, he says, just as it did in 1871, 1914, and 1939. Here's where you wish the historian would take it a step further. Okay, there's been a longer recess this time, but currently, Germany's now divided. This is me talking. But even he writes, Germany currently dominates Europe, just like it did in 1871, 1914, and 1939. So where is this leading then? That's what I would ask him. Maybe he has some thoughts on it that he won't write about. Who knows? He's a good historian nonetheless. It says European peace is maintained only when Germany channels its enormous energy and talents into economic, not military, dominance. But you look at all these surveys, like I covered in the first segment, and then the calls for a European military, a united European military. And these calls are coming from outside of Germany, from France. Well, they're coming from inside Germany as well. I mentioned this just the other day. He says, yet even today, on matters such as illegal immigration, overdue loans, Brexit, and trade surpluses, Germany tends to agitate its allies. And so what happens? What happens when Germany gets the united military? Already they're agitating. Already they're bullying. And now they have a government that's in transition. They have earth-shaking developments in the government in Germany. Well, he finishes by saying the Roman numeral point, to count the wars now. After, and few believe that when the shooting stops, the war is necessarily over. That's from Victor Davis Hanson's latest column, talking about some of the lessons that we can take away from the Great War, the war of 100 years ago. Well, the one other point that I want to bring out with respect to this history is that World War I really was, even though, as I said at the start, even though Britain was one of the winners, one of the victors, World War I really was the beginning of the end of the British Empire. This is something that William Manchester brings out in his first volume on Churchill. The beginning of the end. You look at the enthusiasm, the excitement among Britons leading into World War I, and then see how that nation, the spirit of the nation, was pretty much shattered following that world war. Manchester just talks about some of the changes that were happening in the first 2 decades of the 20th century. Some of the changes in morals and religion and in education. He writes, the Bible had lost its grip on Englishmen. He's talking about the first decade of the 1900s. The Bible lost its grip on Englishmen. People were groping for a substitute. The new vogues were popular psychology, pragmatism, and Nietzscheanism. So what happens when you replace the Bible with Nietzsche? Edwardians, that was the time period of the first decade, Edwardians were bombarded by news of discoveries, glands, hormones, vitamins, genes, Einstein's E equals MC squared, Pavlovian conditioned reflexes, and the subconscious, as revealed by Freud, Adler, and Jung. So it was a very modern time. Lots of advancement in science and technology. It says, fruits of inventive genius promised more excitement to come. But the cumulative effect of all this change, which should have broadened the human vision, gave men a sense of confinement and helplessness. That's the great paradox that Herbert Armstrong talked about so much. You have all of this advancement, all of these developments in technology, and you would think that these developments would broaden the human vision, that these developments or advancements would be used for the good of humanity. Instead, it gave men a sense of confinement and helplessness. Well, even still, going into that great war, there was enough of that empire spirit, that love of country spirit, there was enough of it still to send in millions of volunteers to support the war effort. In the first 2 years of World War I, 2.5 million young British men, 2.5 million volunteered for the war effort. They could not wait to fight for a country, for empire. The Telegraph here in the UK, it had a piece a few years ago. It said, writing about this history, for many years we have commemorated the armistice on Remembrance Sunday with appropriate levels of mournfulness. But as we approach the centenary, it is interesting to consider what the national mood was like before the war started. Our shock today at how the war unfolded is tempered by the passage of time and the knowledge of ultimate victory. The combatants had no such consolation. In that long, hot summer of 1914, when the world fell apart, Britain was at the peak of its fortunes, with London, the capital of a world empire. Much of the poignancy of the First World War comes from the transformation of mood over its 4 years. Gone was the expansive optimism of those Edwardian years, with ludicrously young men bowling up to recruitment offices, broad grins on their faces, as they stood on tiptoe and stuck out their chest in order to appear older. In its place came the horror and the cynicism. Towards the end of the war, officers noticed that men stopped singing the morale-boosting songs they had invented themselves and were reduced instead to the miserable, characteristically English, downbeat cry of, "We're here because we're here, because we're here." More than 700,000 Britons were killed in World War I. And yet still, I think the nation in that time period knew that they didn't die in vain. They were fighting for freedom. But the toll that it took, that's what's brought out in Manchester's work, and as you just heard there from that Telegraph piece. And just the numbers, too, 700,000 slaughtered. That war left 160,000 young English widows. It left 300,000 children in Britain fatherless. Britain lost a generation of leaders. What an impact it had. A negative impact at that. Here it was, I mean, following the war, technically speaking, it would reach its peak in terms of territory. I think the British Empire reached its territorial peak in 1933. For the most part, this is Manchester. For most post-war Britons, it seemed imperial songs and slogans had become empty ritual. They gathered in the spoils of war after World War I, but see, after that great war, it was a different nation. For most post-war Britons, it seemed, imperial songs and slogans had become an empty ritual. In their hearts, they didn't much care. The British were losing interest in their empire. So even more tragic than the impact it had on the family, the loss of all those young men, was that Britain, following World War I, they were losing interest in the empire. You've heard all about that Oxford Union debate in 1933. And how that a majority of young Brits in the early 1930s said that they would not fight for king and country. Under no circumstances would I fight for king and country. That was approved by 275 to 153. Even the king himself at the time said, I cannot look into the future without feeling no little anxiety about the continued unity of the empire. He knew it was slipping away. Churchill knew it was slipping away. Churchill was a man of empire. That's what motivated him. We've talked about that so many times before. But he was disturbed, as were some others. Churchill believed, this is from Manchester, that the empire gave Britain its prestige. It made Britain the world's most powerful nation. Without its imperial possessions, the country would be merely an obscure island lying off the European continent. He said, once we lose our confidence in our mission in the East, it will be a presence which cannot long endure. What will we become if we give up the empire? Well, that's happened. I have another article here from 2014 saying that the First World War helped to dethrone a superpower. In 1914, Britain sat atop the greatest empire the history of the world had ever seen. And it talks about how that the country's elite were particularly devastated. All these young officers who led their troops into those trenches, into that machine gun fire. It says, of the men who graduated from Oxford in 1913, for example, 31% were killed. These are Oxford graduates. The graduating class from 1913, a third of them were killed. And then, of course, there's all the debt that's associated with war. That piled high. This was the period that the sun was setting on the British Empire, the great British Empire. Another one here. This is from the BBC. 2011, the expense of World War I destroyed British global preeminence. Territorially, the British Empire was larger than ever. In the Middle East, Britain and France had divided most of the former Ottoman Empire between them. But the underlying reality was that Britain could no longer afford to build the bases or ships to defend its empire as it had before 1914. It was the United States' overwhelming industrial might that had swung the balance against Germany during the war, and it was the American president whose ideas defined the peace. The years between the world wars were Britain's last hurrah as the great imperial power it had been for the previous 200 years. And so it's like Mr. Armstrong said in the United States and Britain in Prophecy, these two brother nations, this sudden spurt of growth to national power and greatness coming in the early 1800s, and the power that they wielded all through the 1800s, on into the 1900s. Between them, they'd acquired more than two-thirds, almost three-fourths, of the cultivated physical resources and wealth of the world. But as he goes on to say, God fulfilled his promise of bestowing those blessings he promised to Abraham. He fulfilled his promise. And now, well, you see us caught up in our sins, transgressions coming to a full. As he wrote, Britain's sun has now set. As these same prophecies that foretold Britain's greatness revealed far in advance, Britain has already been reduced to a second-rate or third-rate power in the world. It's happened to Britain, and it's happening to the United States. Even though we might have a temporary resurgence, it's happening. And you can go back and look at that history. There's a lot of other things you could analyze besides just World War I and the effect of that on the British Empire. But it really does, looking back at some of this history, considering this on Remembrance Day, besides honoring those brave souls who sacrificed their lives for our nations, like Victor Davis Hanson says, what lessons can we take away from these world struggles? What can we learn from them? Those are good questions to consider on this Remembrance Day weekend. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you next week.